in the rhetoric surrounding artificial intelligence, where on the one hand, we are creating things that only human beings made in the image of God, I would say, can create. We're going to create robots that run faster and are stronger than us, computers that are cleverer than us. What's the net result of that? The net result of that is we think human beings are rather mediocre. Our brilliance is making us feel mediocre. So our godlike aspirations and our breaking of the limits that we see are imposed upon us is actually not leading to the Nietzschean overman, but degrading us to the level of all other animals. I'm basically picking up on the logic laid out, say, in Genesis 3, where, you know, the serpent says to Eve, God knows that if you eat the fruit, you'll be like him. She eats the fruit and she's immediately ashamed. There is this Promethean shame that kicks in, and I think we're experiencing that today. The revolutions of modernity are revolutions of transgression, crossing the boundaries of the limits that we've inherited or limits that are intrinsic to us. The promise was we would be liberated. We would be gods. The result is we have become contingent mediocrities in our own eyes.
It's a very dark picture. Welcome to Socrates Dialogues. I'm Mary Harrington. Today I have the tremendous privilege to be joined by a noted and very influential professor of divinity. He's a professor at Grove City College in Pennsylvania, and he's a fellow of the EPPC. He's a very influential writer on an enormous number of topics, ranging from theology through to sex and gender, critiques of the sexual revolution, and it's just such a pleasure to finally meet you, Carl Truman. Thank you for coming.
It's great to be with you, Mary. Thanks for the kind introduction.
So, Carl, let's start with the self. I mean, we could start with yourself, but I think we should start with the self,
Yeah. Really.
I mean, one of the books that you're best known for is The Rise of the Modern Self, where really the question I wanted to, you know, what is the modern self? Is it something distinct from the soul? How did we get to this modern self and what is it?
Yeah, well, the way I'm using the term self in that book is really how we understand ourselves in relation to the world around.
Mm-hmm.
The question that I was interested in when I started to do the research for that book was, how has the statement, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, mm-hmm. come to make intuitive sense mm-hmm. to so many people today, where for my grandfather, it mm-hmm. would have been nonsense. He would mm-hmm. not have had the categories for it. So I was really attempting to get at what you might call self-understanding. Mm-hmm. And in exploring that question, I came to the conclusion that really the self-understanding of what it means to be human has completely transformed mm-hmm. over the last 500, 600, 700 years. Mm-hmm. You know, if I'd been born in the Middle Ages and you'd asked me, who are you? Mm-hmm. Pretty much everything I'd have said in response would have connected me to something external and, as far as I was concerned, unchanging.
Mm-hmm.
A particular place where I was born, lived and died, mm-hmm. or would die, the local church, the fields that my family mm-hmm. tilled, mm-hmm. The calling that my family had mm-hmm. as farmers or as blacksmiths mm-hmm. or something. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, of course, if you ask the question, who am I? How do I understand myself? You're more likely to answer with things that you have chosen.
Mm-hmm.
Or perhaps even things that you feel inside. And it was that move to the sort of radical freedom of choice, of identity, that came to intrigue me as I was working mm-hmm. on the project. So it ended up being much larger than how do we understand gender, and became really how do we understand ourselves and how do we imagine ourselves in the world around us.
What's the I that's saying I identify as?
Yes, That turned to the subject, which of course becomes more and more complicated, the more fluid the world is.
And of course, one of the interesting things about this trajectory towards the modern self, as we think of it now, is that some of that displacement from the permanent things, the exterior things, was actually quite violent. That was a violent process and a violent experience for the people who went through it. And I'm thinking of one particular example here, which is the English poet John Clare, who was roughly a contemporary of the early Romantics. He was writing roughly circa Byron, but he was a peasant. He lived in Northamptonshire, and he came from subsistence farming people, and he was self-educated, and he wrote these exquisite nature poems and just beautifully observed, minutely observed poetry about the world he was familiar with. And then he was his whole village, his whole people, his whole community was displaced through the Enclosure Acts. And he went mad.
Yeah.
He was so fundamentally deranged. He writes these absolutely heartbreaking poems about the landscape being literally the hedges being deracinated. But what he's actually talking about is his people being forcibly torn from the land. And he ended his life in a mental hospital, writing sort of Byronic parody. In this completely sort of deranged mode, where it's all sort of very visionary and very fundamentally disconnected, because he was. And there's a sort of astonishing you in microcosm. There's a tragedy of an entire displaced people.
Yeah.
You see a different side of it, I think.
Yes, and that actually reminds me of the novels of Thomas Hardy. I grew up in the West Country, mm-hmm. loved the novels of Thomas Hardy, and of course Jude the Obscure is really a story of the collision of the New World and the Old World, and the inability to make a peaceful transfer between the two. So that's John Clare's story is very tragic, as is Jude Fawley's story in Thomas Hardy.
Yeah. And it seems to me sometimes as though the story, like both the superpower of the English peoples, you know, as we've spread out around the world, and also our deepest wound lies somewhere in that having come being unmoored from the land, being deracinated.
Yes.
You know, it's a constituent part of who we are as a modern people. In a way which I think we're sort of struggling to reckon with now.
Yes, I think the emergence of the so-called laptop class, where we are all everywhere all the time, has significant effects on how we understand ourselves and generally not. And I speak as a member of the laptop class.
Right.
But it has a displacing effect on us, that unless we anchor ourselves consciously in certain ways, will really be very damaging to us in the long term.
And when you say anchor ourselves in certain ways, do you have specific things in mind or specific actions or?
Yeah. Marriage would be one. Anchor ourselves in marriage. Commit, cut off options.
Yeah.
My wife and I,
narrow your options. Yeah, reduce optionality.
Yes,
fewer choices.
I have pastor friends who've already bought their grave sites in the towns where they pastor because they want to commit there. And, my wife and I bought a house in Western Pennsylvania, which we love to open up for people to come round and enjoy hospitality. That we don't do our socializing mediated by technology. Mm. We do it around the dining table. Mm. Small points of resistance, but I think significant. Mm.
Now, another book that you're well known for, which I think keys into this as well, because the modern self that you're talking about is really the self of the laptop class. That's the kind of final form of this very mercurial, we're not sure what the I is that's doing the identifying, but it somehow floats free of the world and operates laptops and sits in airport lounges and so on.
There is no doer
behind the deed, and yet somehow a lot of doing gets done of a kind. But another book you've written, which I think is germane to this, explores the history of the sexual revolution. You've looked at some of the key thinkers who fed into this modern idea and understanding of sexuality, which really feels like it's a central component in the modern self.
Yeah,
is a kind of theology of a sort of secularized theology of sexuality.
Yeah.
Or a kind of a perverse kind of anti-sanctification of sexuality in a way that becomes very important. I wonder if you could say who are some of those key thinkers and what are the streams that have flowed into this idea and how does it operate?
Well, I think the origins certainly of the sort of revolutionary idea of sex lie in the writings of the early Marx, where he focuses on religion and the smashing of religion as key to social revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the 20th century, that's picked up by the early writers of the so-called Frankfurt School, the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, who see the sexual taboos by which bourgeois society organizes itself as central to the oppressive nature of bourgeois society. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, how does that connect to Marx's critique of religion? Well, who is it that maintains sexual taboos in the West? Typically, it's been Christianity and the church. So the Marxist polemic against religion morphs into a Marxist polemic against so-called bourgeois sexual morality. So you think of people like Wilhelm Reich, Herbert Marcuse, who writes, Reich's writing in the 30s. Mm-hmm. Marcuse is writing really in the 40s,
'cause 50s. Reich's whole thing, wasn't it, was he was convinced that sexual repression had caused Hitler. Like, I mean, this is a very truncated version of his vision.
Yes, you have these, why is it the working class support Hitler rather than the communists? Mm. Well, Reich's rather simplistic theory was working class families are very hierarchical. They have a strong male figure at the top. You grow up in this house where you are repressed by the strong male figure. You become dependent on the strong male figure. You leave home. You look for the strong male figure. Well, it's the diminutive Austrian corporal with the Charlie Chaplin moustache. You know, that he fits the role perfectly. And
Wilhelm Reich seems like he has some fairly grave daddy issues here. To deploy another key 20th century thinker on sexuality.
Freud.
I kind of feel like Freud had a similar analysis in some ways, but he didn't think it was a bad thing.
No,
he just thought it was a thing.
Freud clearly thought that some sexual repression enabled civilization, enabled culture, as we would say. Reich actually worked for Freud, and Freud sort of got rid of him because he felt he was too extreme. So there was an interesting personal connection there between the two of them. What's interesting about the Frankfurt School, and I knew about this but was never able to trace it to a primary source until last week, actually, when a student finally tracked it down for me, is that Erich Horkheimer, who was a Frankfurt School thinker, in the late 1960s, he supported the Pope's Humanae Vitae, on the grounds that he felt the sexual revolution had really gone too far and had led to the objectification of other people. Obviously,
Who could have imagined?
Yes. and Marcuse comes out swinging in favor of a ban on contraception. I can send you the reference afterwards if you want to see it. It's a fascinating thing.
We need to add this to the notes for the video.
But there you have a great example of the revolution, a revolutionary realizing actually the revolution beginning to consume its own, or at least its own ideology at that point.
You know, not so much trying to consume its own children, but trying to create more of them.
Yes.
in this case. So even the Frankfurt School concluded in the end that the revolutionary dismantling of bourgeois sexual norms had perhaps gone too far and was proving destructive.
Certainly in the case of Horkheimer. Absolutely.
I mean, I think if you look at more contemporary reporting on the relationship between family breakdown and poverty and dysfunction and suffering, particularly in lower socioeconomic groups, it seems pretty clear to me that the alternatives to what Reich was trying to dismantle are not necessarily better than what currently.
Not at all. And one might say that the mortgage payments on the sexual revolution are played by the poorest and most vulnerable
100%,
in society.
You know, 100%.
Hollywood dismantles marriage and sexual morality. But those people generally have the money to protect themselves from the excesses of what they're doing. You know, it's the streets of Philadelphia where you see the really sad consequences.
Occasionally gets pointed out the people who are keenest on being relativistic about family formation and so on, typically married, typically quite stably married, you know, typically have kids, you know, typically don't get divorced.
Yeah.
Funnily enough, are not practicing what they preach on this.
They understand in their own lives the need for stability. Mm.
But there's a sense in which we don't want to use that. We just want people to have the option.
Yeah.
You know, and it seems to me that there's a general conviction that not saying to people you should is conceived of as the highest good in some way.
Yeah.
You know, the idea that you must leave people absolutely free under absolutely every possible and imaginable circumstance. And if you don't do that, you're a bad person. What do you mean you're against freedom?
Yeah.
But that perhaps there are some situations where it's wrong and cruel to not make a prescriptive suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, to use the old cliched analogy, if you see somebody freely running towards the edge of a cliff, it's not cruel to intervene and stop them from jumping over it.
Yeah, and I suppose the bigger question behind all of this, and the question that gets swerved by the, oh, I must just leave you free to do whatever it is that you want, The reason people end up defaulting to this sort of absolute, it's kind of a variant of libertarianism, or it's actually quite a sociopathic stance in my personal view, is that that comes about when as a consequence of having rejected in principle the idea that some choices are better than others,
yeah,
some pathways are better than others, and that in turn rests on the idea that there are that there's no such thing as human nature, that this is not something which exists in any sense that we can objectively perceive.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is actually, you know, we'll touch on your latest book, The Desecration of Man, in a moment. But this is really a sort of central component of what you're talking about here, is this idea which has been a core component of Christianity since forever, the Imago Dei. This is the idea that, you know, we're created in God's image, and, you know, from which flows the idea, flows a clear inference that there are some things that we could be doing, yeah, better than others, you know, and there's definitely
there's
good.
There's a telos. There's, yeah, an end.
There's an end to
yeah.
But so I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the desecration of man and how it flows out of of your previous work on sexuality and identity.
Yeah. Well, I was interested in, after I'd done the work on expressive individualism and this, mm-hmm, idea of autonomy, I was wondering if that actually had a specific moral shape, or was, mm-hmm, it just a thing? And I came to the conclusion that it does have a specific moral shape, and that moral shape is transgression,
mm-hmm,
the transgression, mm-hmm, of inherited values.
Mm.
Where are those values inherited in the West? Mm. Typically from some broadly Christian, mm, tradition. So expressive individualism manifests itself most obviously in the transgressing of, mm-hmm, of Christian, mm, values. The question then becomes, if we're overthrowing God, mm, by our transgression, does that liberate us or does that degrade us? And I'm intrigued by the fact that actually our transgressions have typically not led to us being godlike.
Mm.
They've reduced us in significant, mm, ways. And we even see this perhaps most significantly at the moment in the rhetoric surrounding artificial intelligence,
mm-hmm,
where on the one hand, you know, we are creating things that only human beings made in the image of God, I would say, can create.
Mm.
We're going to create robots that run faster and are stronger than us, computers that are cleverer than us. What's the net result of that? The net result of that is we think human beings are rather mediocre.
Mm.
Our brilliance is making us feel mediocre. So our godlike aspirations and our breaking of the limits that we see are imposed upon us is actually not leading to the Nietzschean overman.
Mm.
But degrading us to the level of all other animals.
Yeah, I listened to a talk recently from a senior executive in an AI company, who at one point, you know, he's saying, you know, we should be clear what we're doing here is we're creating a new species, and then he said we've never created a species before, and I turned to the person next to me and I said, hang on a minute, I birthed a baby, like. You birthed two babies.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is not
you
our
created.
First. You know, what are you talking about, yeah, Mr. AI? You know, this is, yeah, humans create conscious beings all the time.
Yes.
You know, but open your eyes.
Yeah, human reproduction is the most godlike action we ever engage in.
But I think the point that you're making is that in looking past something as ordinary and also miraculous as motherhood, as, you know, as human reproductivity, yeah, to this sort of technical or, you know, artificial or, you know, this sort of technical creativity, what we're doing is we're disavowing what it is that's miraculous about people.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And in the process, we're diminishing ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, certainly I felt diminished as a mother. It was a passing thing.
Yeah.
But I felt for a moment quite diminished by the,
yeah,
you know.
I mean, clearly it impacts how women think about themselves, but also impacts how society thinks about children.
Mm.
You know, we tend, you know, children are no longer a miraculous and unique gift of, mm-hmm, grace, we might say. They become, mm, products that we are able,
yeah,
to design and
there
produce.
Was a very telling line, actually, I think, in an interview that Sam Altman, who's another of these AI,
yeah,
leaders, made with an interlocutor. He said something to the effect that, oh, you know, people worry about the amount of energy it takes to train an AI. And then he said, but, you know, it takes 18 to 20 years to raise a baby before they get smart.
Yeah.
So what was the child between 0 and 18 then?
Yes.
You know, what I mean, you know, just, really?
The reduction of a child to an algorithm. It's deeply sad.
You know, and as you say, there's a sort of unintentional, but surely unintentional, but very active sort of diminishment implicit in that.
Yes.
But I mean, but your thesis is much bigger than, I mean, it touches only briefly, I think, on AI here and there. But really, your thesis is much bigger, and it encompasses a whole ecology of anti-human ideas and technologies.
I'm basically picking up on the logic laid out, say, in Genesis 3, where, you know, the serpent says to Eve, you know, God knows that if you eat the fruit, you'll be like him. She eats the fruit and she's immediately ashamed. There is this Promethean shame that kicks in. And I think we're experiencing that today. Yeah, the revolutions of modernity are revolutions of transgression, crossing the boundaries of the limits that we've inherited or limits that are intrinsic to us. The promise was we would be liberated. We would be gods. The result is we have become contingent mediocrities in our own eyes.
It's a very dark picture. Now, we're almost out of time for this, unfortunately, very short session,
right,
Carl. So tell me, what are the three things, what are the three themes that we should, when we resume this session, as we're planning to in the coming months, what are the three themes that we should lean into? One of the themes that I want to touch on is reconcentration.
Yeah.
I wonder what else you would like to bring from your book, and where else...
I think looking at attitudes to death is also significant.
Yes.
The rise of assisted suicide, for example, is very, very significant. I think, and also looking at the way Nietzsche sets up the problem in the 19th century,
I think
he really calls the bluff on Enlightenment rationalism.
Yep.
So and reconsecration would be the three.
Reconsecration. And one last thing, you know, this is a topic close to both of our hearts, really, the technologization of reproduction.
Yes.
You know, which is so, it brings all of these themes together, of human personhood, biotechnology, the Promethean mindset, and the question of what it is to be a person.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so looking forward to that conversation,
so
Carl. It's going to be marvellous. I'm sorry this is such a short session today, but I look forward immensely.
We can blame London Transport for that.
But I look forward so much to continuing the conversation.
Likewise,
with you next
it's been
time.
An honour and
Thank
a privilege
so
to
much.
Be Mary. Thank you.
You might be thinking, that's not Eric Metaxas. My name's Mary Harrington. I'm a writer and a past contributor to Socrates in the City. I'm thrilled to be joining Socrates in the City as the first inaugural Socrates contributor. Throughout 2026, I'll be hosting many fascinating conversations on life, God, and other small topics. Be sure to subscribe to get notifications whenever a new episode from Eric or myself drops. And thank you for tuning in.